Hello and welcome to Fourth Estate, a show about journalism. We're coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on the Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. I'm Monica Attard. The Russian invasion of Ukraine is now 2 weeks old, with Russian forces entrenched, but apparently also bogged down in various parts of Ukraine. Last week, we asked if the war could have been avoided, and we also struggled to find an end game for Putin in Russia. This week, we ask fundamental questions about Russia's ability to stay the course, and is the stranglehold on the flow of information that Putin has on the war in Russia working, or is he also struggling on the home front? In this edition, we break from our usual panel discussion and get two separate and important perspectives, one Ukrainian and one Russian. First off, we speak with Zoya Sheftalovich, who is a contributing editor for Politico. She's worked in Brussels for Politico, as well as working for Choice magazine, and she has even been a foreign correspondent for 2SER. Zoya, thank you for joining us here on Fourth Estate. First off, you're Ukrainian. Tell us how you've been feeling over the last couple of weeks, and are you at all hopeful at this point for your country?
To be honest, I started out extremely devastated, and when the war was initially announced, my assumption was that it was going to be over pretty quickly. I thought that Kyiv would probably fall within the first 24 to 48 hours, and at that point, it would all be over. I'm starting to feel both more and less hopeful now. The reason I'm more hopeful is because obviously Ukraine is putting up much more of a fight than any of us really saw coming. The level of unity and the level of resistance that I've seen has been quite incredible, and it has really been something that has been, I think no one really saw it coming. None of us externally saw it coming. I'm also more devastated as the days go on, because Putin's brutality becomes more and more severe, and the human cost of this becomes worse and worse. And that is, I mean, the scenes that we're seeing now of the maternity hospital in Mariupol being shelled, of civilians just being completely annihilated, that has been horrific to watch from my relative, well, not relative, but my safety in Australia. It's been very difficult to watch those scenes and feel so helpless about it.
There has been a lot of commentary that the Russian army doesn't seem to be in the state that everybody assumed it would be in. But do you think that could be underestimating what could be coming Ukraine's way?
I think it probably is. And I think the main thing is that the army being in the state that it's in makes it more likely that more forceful and worse weapons will be used. Because if you can't win that war in the initial short and sharp phase, and if you're having to move to the cluster munitions, if you're running out of the more precise weaponry and you're having to use the cluster munitions and the carpet bombs, that is really worrying. And I think the other thing that people don't quite understand, I think the biggest mistake people in the West, politicians and those who are watching the West, have made is to look at the situation that is happening on the ground and view Putin from the perspective of someone who is acting in a rational Western way. Whereas Putin has never been the sort of person who someone in the West can judge. So I think people look at it and go, oh, well, he can't possibly win, and how long can he possibly keep going? This will force him to the negotiating table. Whereas I look at that scenario and I think he's getting more and more desperate, and this is going to lead to more and more violence and violence that is against the civilian population.
I guess it's fair enough to say, though, that he really has to win this war, doesn't he? Both for internal Russian purposes and his own survival, but also on the international stage. He's not going to want to be humiliated. He's not going to want to back down in any way. You've written a couple of things that we found really interesting. You said at one point that Putin's thinking of Ukraine is rooted in a 1991 mindset, and he doesn't understand modern Ukraine or Ukrainians. Can you talk to us a little bit about what you meant by that?
So the reason I wrote that is because under the Soviet Union, Ukraine was essentially a country within the USSR. It was its own country, but it didn't have a great deal of its own identity. So, for instance, I myself am Ukrainian. I was born in Ukraine. We all spoke, for the most part, Russian. A lot of Ukrainians did still speak Ukrainian, but Russian was considered the language of choice. Anyone who spoke Ukrainian, particularly those who didn't speak Russian or those who spoke Russian with a Ukrainian accent, was considered something akin to a country bumpkin. There was this Russian exceptionalism and Russian kind of lionization that happened in Russia and externally, where there was this idea that your goal must always be to want to live in Russia because that's where all the money was. And I think that is where his conceptualization of Ukraine stayed. It's this idea of Ukraine as this nothing country that doesn't have its own people and barely has its own language. But I think things have really changed, and they started changing in the early 2000s, around about when Yushchenko came to power and when he implemented Ukrainian curriculum and started putting up statues to Ukrainian figures, started teaching in the curriculum about Ukrainian figures of the past. And since then, it has repeatedly, various points in time in Ukraine have really solidified that Ukrainian mindset. And I think some of those key points in time were, of course, the Maidan Revolution, when the Putin puppet that was in power in Kiev was replaced by Poroshenko in what was a popular uprising. Then, in reaction to that, after Putin pushed into Crimea and Donbass under the guise of local separatists, but what everyone knows was in fact just Putin's own forces propping those up, Ukrainians really at that point started becoming, having a sense of national pride, national identity, but also started changing the way they viewed Russia as well. There was this kind of confusion in a way about what Putin would and wouldn't do. And he was funding lots of politicians in Ukraine. So there were popular and large Ukrainian politicians who were in fact Putin puppets. And it was a little bit of a confusing thing for people, you know, were they Ukrainians or what were they? But in response to that Crimean war and the Donbass so-called People's Republics, that is when we really saw Ukrainians come together. And I think that really culminated in the election of Volodymyr Zelensky, who came to power in 2019 as a sort of a TV star, a really popular TV star who had been on this show called Servant of the People, where he played a history teacher who went viral in a YouTube video going on a rant about corruption and then was made the president of Ukraine. There was a lot of art imitating life, where then on the back of the popularity of that TV show and the sentiment that that TV show was plugging into, they then, as a result of that, Zelensky was elected on this anti-corruption platform. And certainly since he came to power, he has been on a bit of a campaign to get rid of graft and get rid of corruption in his country. Now, he's not perfect. By no means is he perfect. And there have been some difficult moments, and certainly some of his policies have not necessarily been particularly popular or necessarily the right way to go. But as a general statement, he has certainly been cracking down on corruption and on Russian influence in Ukraine. And I think that was really the thing that Putin couldn't stand. And so I think Putin was viewing Ukraine as a nothing, as a place that didn't have an identity, a place where you could replace the government and no one would notice, no one would care, people would just go about their daily business. So I think when he rolled his troops into Ukraine now, his view was that they would just lay down their arms and let it happen. And I think the fact that the Ukrainians have really fought back with such significant opposition has shocked him and the world.
I guess that analysis kind of raises two questions in my mind. Firstly, I mean, the way Putin has put it forward, his analysis is that when you look at it historically, the difference between Russia and Ukraine simply isn't there. Now, in his mind, of course, that negates Ukraine as a sovereign state. So, I mean, I'd like to get your comment on what you think are the links the positive links, if you like, between Russia and Ukraine?
Historically, there are obviously strong links between Russia and Ukraine. So in terms of language, many, many Ukrainians speak Russian. For many, many Ukrainians, it's something like 40%. Russian is actually their first language. Mm-hmm. So there's a definite linguistic link there. And historically, as part of the Soviet Union, as two parts of the Soviet Union, Ukraine and Russia were sort of sister countries. Away with Moscow, the place of power, the seat of power, and where most of the government was, but still sort of two sisters in a larger kind of whole, which was the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And certainly they have a shared history. The Red Army is a hugely important element of Soviet symbolism, and the fact that Ukrainians and Russians fought together in the Second World War in the Red Army, and that was a really important element of their joint history and of their symbolism. So they viewed themselves as brothers and sisters in arms. So there is a great deal of similarity and a great deal of fraternity there. But at the same time, there has always been a strong Ukrainian nationalism and patriotism that existed within Ukraine. It's not accurate to say that Ukraine and Russia were one, or that their people were always one. If you go back to the time of Tsarist times, there were already Ukrainian nationalists who were fighting for independence. That continued throughout the Second World War, when you had figures like Bandera, who was a well-known Ukrainian nationalist who was fighting for independence from all of the countries that were trying to step in and take a chunk of Ukraine. So there's always been an individual identity of Ukrainianness and Ukrainian nationalists that existed prior to and during the Soviet Union. And once Ukraine declared independence, I mean, Ukraine declared independence after a vote in which a vast majority of Ukrainians voted to split from the USSR. So Ukraine became independent before the USSR actually finally fell apart. And I remember those times. I remember that vote. I remember the way people felt. They felt strongly about the fact that Ukraine ought to be its own country. And so I think this revisionist history that Putin has is a very, it's a very patronizing and imperialistic view of Ukraine, which excludes the idea that Ukrainians have always wanted to have wanted their own country, and particularly have been fighting for their own country in the last few decades since the fall of the Soviet Union.
And so, just in relation to picking up on something that you said earlier as well, in terms of the influences, we've talked about Russian influence. Are you at all concerned, or have you been at all concerned about the influence of the United States within Ukraine, particularly in the Zelensky era?
I think the US always has an interest in propping up democracies around the world. And I think there's a particular interest in doing that in a region where you're next door to a dictatorship that is a hostile force, and that is the case with Putin's Russia. That said, look, I think I have a strong support for democracy and for self-determination in the case of Ukraine. And so I think if the situation is that Zelensky has advisors or has assistance from the EU, from the US, that to me is less of a problem than the fact that Putin is actively declaring war on the country. And I think the thing with Ukraine is that since 2014, it has had the desire to join the EU and to join NATO as an element of its constitution. It's something that is very popular within Ukraine, and that is a goal, a stated goal that they've had for years. And in terms of that influence from the US, look, to me, it isn't an issue in the same way that the influence of Russia is an issue, because of the different goals of the influence. So the goal of US influence is very different in this circumstance to the goal.
And you're not worried at all that Ukraine is being used as a proxy by the United States to fight a broader war with Russia?
I think Ukraine is being used as a proxy in this case by Putin's forces. So I think Putin's forces going into Ukraine is effectively fighting a war against the West and against democracy. So I think it's already inevitably being used as a proxy. And the outcome that I am interested in is an ongoing democracy and Ukraine that is able to have its own territory and have its own self-determination. And there's really only one side that is looking after that interest.
Okay. So look, at the end of the day, I mean, all wars are about taking and defending territory, but they're also about information, and where this war is being played out in a social media age. You know, nobody has any doubt Ukraine is winning that social media war and Russia is losing it monumentally. Does it matter, really, given that there is literally no chance that the West, NATO and the US in particular, will come to Ukraine's aid in a more direct way than they already have?
I think it absolutely matters. And I think actually the West has come to Ukraine's aid in many concrete ways. I think the fact that weapons are being shipped into Ukraine by the ton from the US, from the EU, is hugely consequential. The amount of money that's going into Ukraine is hugely consequential. And I think that is all made possible by the fact that the Ukrainians have been playing a magnificent game of chess when it comes to social media. And in fact, I think it's also clear from the warnings that the US was giving. And I remember when they started making these warnings of an imminent invasion, people were a bit confused and were saying, oh, why is the US doing this? This is quite extraordinary. Why are they declassifying this information? Didn't make any sense. But I think what the US recognized, what Ukraine has recognized, is that it's really important to take away some of Russia's ability to obfuscate and confuse people in terms of what is actually happening, because that's when people switch off because they're too confused to figure out who's in the right. In this case, the fact that Ukraine is able to effectively preempt Russia's attempts at false flag information, the fact that they're able to get information out there about things like attacks on their nuclear power plants, that is super important. The fact that they're able to get images out of these besieged cities like Mariupol, where you've got pictures of hospitals and streets completely destroyed, people completely destroyed, civilians being evacuated, being fired upon, that is all really important, because what it does is it stops Putin from being able to continue to obfuscate the problem. It stops the opportunity for him to then recover on the other end of this and say, well, war's over, how about you start buying our gas and oil again? So I think it's really important for Ukraine to maintain that pressure. And of course, it's also really important from the perspective of morale, because what we're seeing is this overwhelming image of Ukraine taking down tanks, taking down airplanes, taking down helicopters. And I think that is also very helpful, because what it says is, hey, we might actually win this. So if you send us lots and lots of weapons and lots of money, you might actually help us win it. And I think that was a very important thing that Ukraine did, rather than make it appear as if Putin winning was inevitable, which would mean that what's the point of sending money? What's the point of sending weapons to Ukraine? They're just going to end up in Putin's hands. I think that has really been impactful from that perspective. In terms of the Russians, look, for Putin and for the Russian state-run media, the important people who they are trying to get their information to are Russians themselves. And so in some ways, the fact that Russians have been cut off from Facebook, Twitter, etc., while it has had the positive effect of reducing some of those avenues for false propaganda from the Russian side, it has also meant that the Russian people are being cut off from information.
But they also have access to VPN. I mean, there are modern Ukrainians, but there are also many modern Russians, and they are arming themselves now with VPNs. Do you think, you know, that message of what is actually happening in Ukraine is getting through to at least a proportion of the Russian population, and that will make a difference?
I think it is getting through to a proportion of a population, and particularly younger people are more likely to access this information. But I think, as we've seen from reports in the New York Times and elsewhere from my own reporting, it's very obvious that even people who are being told firsthand by relatives in Ukraine what is happening on the ground are refusing to believe it, because they've been so heavily influenced by the propaganda that the Russians are putting out. And so I think some of these people, they just, the people who are searching for the information might find it, but there are a lot of people who are willfully blind to it, who don't want this information because they've been essentially given this propagandized version of what's happening, this idea that Ukraine is run by Nazis. And I think the impact of that can't really be overstated. A lot of people will be speaking and are speaking. I've got family myself who, when you ask them what is happening, why they think Russia has declared war on Ukraine, they claim that it's a denazification effort when we know that that is not at all the case. So I think, yes, the information is out there should the Russians start looking for it, and they probably can get around firewalls in the same way that Chinese people can access VPNs to be able to get around the blocks on Facebook in China. But nonetheless, a lot of people don't want to do that. They're not looking to do that. And it's one thing if these things keep coming up on your Facebook feed and you can't help but see it. It's another thing you have to go out there and find this information yourself. And I think that active finding of the information is much more, it's a much bigger task for these Russians.
Mm. Zoya, we've run out of time, so we'll leave it there. But I thank you very, very much for being on the show today.
It's my pleasure.
Now let's speak with Leonid Rogozin. Leonid is a Russian based in Riga in Latvia. He has been a freelance journalist who's worked previously for the BBC. And not only is he an insightful and thoughtful journalist, he also wrote The Lonely Planet Guides for Moscow and Ukraine. So obviously he knows both and loves both. So Leonid, thank you very, very much for joining us here today on Fourth Estate. You wrote for Al Jazeera on February 24th a very insightful and nuanced piece about the war. But we're curious because you also asked a big question that you didn't quite answer about Putin. And what you wrote was, on the face of it, Putin's move appears irrational. After 2 weeks of this war, have you formed an opinion about Putin's thinking?
Well, I'm more inclined to think that he is acting irrationally. If you think about Russia's long-term objectives and national interests, because what he is doing essentially is bombing, leveling cities in eastern Ukraine, primarily Russian-speaking cities, in killing people who live in the streets named after Russian great Russian writers and Russian cities, streets in Kharkov named like Moskovsky Moscow Prospect or Chernyshevsky Street. From internal Russian point of view, it sounds not so much counterproductive as suicidal, as a political suicide, because this thing do register with Russians. Not to mention the fact that millions and millions of Russians and pretty much everyone in those Russian-speaking cities in eastern Ukraine, they have relatives and close friends in Russia. So it takes time to sink in Russia, of course. And the Kremlin is doing its best to control information about what is happening, what is going on in eastern Ukraine. But it cannot last for long. So there is this irrational aspect. But at the same time, Putin is working towards an objective. And the objective is to get Ukraine sign a very humiliating peace accord. And if he achieves this, if Ukraine swallows it, if the West swallows it, then yes, in hindsight, we could, to an extent, call him rational. But for now, it looks to me as a political suicide.
And do you think that there are any people around him at the moment who are looking at what we are seeing, this irrational behaviour, and saying that to themselves or to him that they're concerned?
Well, nobody knows, in fact, because we are talking about a very small, close-knit, non-transparent, extremely non-transparent group of people. And we don't know much about the internal psychological dynamics within this group of people. Whether it is Putin who is making those decisions and everybody else is afraid to tell him that he is not right, or whether this is a case of a collective bout of insanity, a collective bout of madness. From what we saw at the memorable Security Council session at the start of this war, it seems like some of the members of the close circle, people like the head of foreign intelligence, Naryshkin, and also Prime Minister Mishustin, they were not probably entirely on board with Putin. They were wavering. How it plays out in behind closed doors, behind the curtains, is unclear. I'm sure that if we speak about broader swathes of the Russian elite, that many people are extremely concerned about their personal future, about the future of their assets in the country, which is now being subject to extreme thermonuclear sanctions. I'm sure that discontent is growing within the elite. Whether it will lead to any kind of open attacks on Putin or any open manifestations of discontent, that's a million-dollar question.
I've been watching what you write and what you tweet in particular, Leonid, for a long time. I think it's fair enough to say that you as well have recognised the two kind of narratives that have, the competing narratives over why this conflict has actually happened. The first, of course, is that the West did not listen to Russia and that it pressured it with NATO expansion. And the counter view is that Putin wanted to return to a more expansive idea of Russia. Some, of course, have expanded that to even mean that he wanted to reinvent the USSR. Has what's happened in the last 2 weeks clarified in your mind what is driving him and this conflict?
Well, I'm still not sure that expansion is his main motivation. If we look at Russian demands at the peace negotiations with Ukraine, and then the demand is that Ukraine recognize the independence of Donetsk and the so-called Donetsk and Luhansk Republic and the Russian occupation of Crimea in 2014. These are chunks of Ukraine, but these are fairly small chunks of Ukraine, and they were occupied in 2014. In the case of Donetsk and Luhansk republics, of course, Putin and the Kremlin are talking about the full territory of Luhansk and Donetsk regions. And much of the territories were controlled by Ukraine by the time this war started. But even so, we're not talking about the occupation of Ukraine. We're not even talking about the occupation of Eastern Russian-speaking part of Ukraine. Not about the new Russia, the Novorossiya project, as envisaged by many Russian nationalists at the beginning of this war. I don't think in practice it is the way Putin moves is consistent with the idea of Putin, trying to restore the Soviet Union or to occupy the whole of Ukraine. What I think is the most important is the logic of escalation and what political scientists call external legitimization. The source, the main source of Putin's legitimacy during the last 10 years, and especially now, is his conflict with the West. And this conflict was escalating as ever since 2014, or even earlier, since the war in Georgia in 2008. And from Putin's point of view, the escalation started when, in the late 90s, the West, the United States and its European allies decided to expand, to start a massive expansion of NATO towards the Russian borders. So I think this logic of escalation, which many in the West dismiss, because it's quite obviously that escalation on the Russian side is disproportionate to what the West is doing, especially now when Putin, in response to what he sees as hostile moves by the West, as the expansion of NATO, he starts actually murdering people and bombing cities. But still, it is the logic of escalation that brought to this collision. And from Putin's point of view, from the Kremlin's point of view, it is this escalatory buildup in the last 10, 20 or more years that has brought us to the collision point.
So in that sense, has the West actually misread Putin post-1991? An alternate explanation that there was something inherent in the breakup of the Soviet Union in 1991, which would inevitably lead to these kind of, you know, in a sense, territorial disputes?
I think the fundamental issue that underpins this whole situation is the fact that in the 1990s, the West had a chance to integrate Russia, to maybe prioritize the integration of Russia just because of its size, and not to mention its nuclear weapons, which created a potential danger to the whole world. And we can see it now that Putin basically threatens nuclear war to the West and to the rest of the world. So maybe it was not so wise to play the salami tactics by cutting off Russia's former allies and neighbors and ushering them into Western Euro-Atlantic structures, while essentially alienating Russia and not working on its integration. Most importantly, not offering to the Russian society this beacon of European integration, which is basically the only reason why other East European nations are now democracies and not authoritarian states like Russia. This framework that comes along with Euro-Atlantic integration, particularly with the integration into the European Union, it is crucial in holding back Putinoid forces in countries like Hungary and Poland, which we can see have made certain steps towards Putinism, towards authoritarianism. But it is this legal rule of law framework imposed on them by Euro-Atlantic integration that prevents them from becoming something 100% akin to Russia.
So given all of that, do you think that if the Ukrainian President Zelensky were to accept, in some meta-universe, if he were to accept this offer from Russia that Ukraine declares itself a neutral state, that it changes its constitution and declares that it will never join NATO, that will be enough? And is it a believable offer?
Well, it's hard to say because we can see with Putin, with each escalatory step, or what he sees as escalatory step by the West. He doubles down. He has this psychology of a 1990s Pittsburgh gangster, where you always need to show that you are more insane, you are more suicidal than the other part. Mm-hmm. And in this game, Putin will always be winning. I mean, in the game of chicken, he is the person who will never blink. He will go all the way until he collides with the with the enemy. I think that in terms of agreeing with Putin, in terms of what many hawkish personalities in the West call appeasement, probably the main element is that nobody has tried, and of course the decision by the Ukrainian government to not to succumb to Russia's pressure, not to implement Minsk agreements the way Russia saw, and to put up a fight, it was obviously backed by Ukrainian society, but the wisdom of this decision is not clear to me at this moment. I mean, history will show whether it was right decision or wrong. But with you know, agreeing to Putin's demand, with signing some kind of agreement with Putin, the main issue is that nobody tried. People just say that it is an appeasement of the dictator, that his appetites will grow. Now we have all those people dying there, and the West is not in position to help them properly, because it cannot send NATO armies or NATO aviation to confront Russia because of the threat of nuclear war. So in that case, maybe it's the best solution would be to find an off ramp for Putin, and that of course involves a major humiliating compromise for Ukraine.
And as you say, that would also include giving up the Donbas and giving up Crimea officially, you know, in terms of international law. Can we just turn our mind to the issue of sanctions for a moment? Because these are, as you call them, thermonuclear sanctions, you know, five times more extensive than those ever placed on Iran, for example. Do they have the capacity at all to change his direction? Or, you know, is he a man who, again, as you say, doesn't blink? He's just going to keep on going, that he will not react to the sanctions?
Well, I think in terms of sanctions against Russia, the main factor is time. If this military campaign and these sanctions last too long, they will start hitting the West and the rest of the world. And in many ways, we're seeing it already with the rising prices on gas and oil. And then the next thing that is going to happen is very high prices for wheat, because both Ukraine and Russia are major exporters of wheat. There'll be an impact for the entire world economy. It may even lead to a global recession. If the West, if Biden administration achieves its goal of stopping Russia really fast, then yes, this strategy is working. If Russia sustains the impact and continues its murderous campaign in Ukraine, the military campaign, then no, it didn't work. So I believe in the next few days or weeks, we will see which is true.
And it's not just the sanctions. There are, you know, major corporations and other groups that are pulling out. A lot of commentary, you know, much of it silly, that McDonald's pulling out is going to harden views in Russia. I mean, I'm sure Putin doesn't really care if there's no McDonald's or Netflix or Apple operating in Russia. But is that hurting the West's ability to connect with everyday Russians?
Well, I guess it hurts the Russians. And this particular issue of all those Western shops and businesses pulling out of Russia, the kind of businesses that Russians were familiar with, it's from my point of view, it may be a positive, because you have this conformist pro-Putin majority in Russia, which is basically endorsing its policies, but it is endorsing those policies, not wholeheartedly, but through political apathy. So maybe it would be a good way of waking up Russian society from its political lethargy and making people think that their inaction, their political conformity, it has a consequences, and if they are not interested in politics, then politics will enter every flat and house in the city, in the country. So that is what is happening, and this is a tangible impact that people will be feeling, at least in the large cities, absolutely immediately, as all those McDonald's outlets and Zara shops are closing down, and there is no way for local suppliers to fill the gap. It's a sudden return to the early 1990s. And people will not appreciate it, and people will be asking questions.
And in relation to the media, you know, what remained of independent media in Russia is or has closed down. I see Medusa is still operating, but, you know, they preferred to close rather than comply with the Kremlin's edict that they tell its version of this war. What's your take on the media in Russia? What lies ahead? Can that small sliver of what was independent media ever revive?
Well, what we had last week is that the Russian parliament has adopted the law which essentially criminalizes the profession of journalists. People cannot cover the war for the simple reason that they cannot even call this war. They cannot use the word war in the context of what the Kremlin calls the special military operation in Ukraine. Objective reporting of the bombardment and of all the civilians that have been killed by Russian bombs and artillery fire, the Russian authorities consider it as fake news. And as of last week, it is now punishable by very lengthy prison sentences, up to 15 years in prison. Inside Russia, the profession of journalist is essentially being killed, and even foreign journalists are moving out of Russia now. However, the hunger for information in Russian society is going to grow. Mm-hmm. And from what I know, from what I hear in Moscow, and from what I'm seeing on social networks, which are banned now in Russia, but Russians are still on through VPN. So people are learning about VPN. People are accessing the Russian independent media outlets that have been recently banned by the Kremlin. And the audience of those outlets is growing, according to according to their management. Mm-hmm. There is a hectic, volatile situation now, as hundreds and hundreds of journalists who worked for independent outlets have left Russia hurriedly, without visas for Western countries. So they ended up in places like Armenia, Georgia, or Turkey, where they can access, where they can come without visas. Then on top of it, Visa and MasterCard decided to stop working with Russian banks. And that left all those Russians who fled persecution in Russia, and particularly journalists, it left them stranded in foreign countries without any cash, because they cannot access their Russian accounts. So it doesn't, of course, help those independent outlets to function normally from their new bases abroad. Mm-hmm. But once it is all settled in some way or another, then people will double down, and they will find access to broader audiences in Russia. And all those outlets, they do matter, and they know how to work with Russian audiences to a large extent better than Western-sponsored media outlets.
Leonard, that's been absolutely fascinating. I thank you very, very much for your time, and wish you the best of luck.
Okay, thank you for having me. Thank you, Monica.
And on that note, Leonard Rogozin, thank you for joining us here on Fourth Estate. And thanks for listening to the program. This edition was recorded at the studios of 2SER and heard across the country on the Community Radio Network. Fourth Estate is produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Thanks to the Foundation for their continuing support. Make sure you subscribe to Fourth Estate on your favourite podcast app so that you can hear us talk media, politics, and of course, everything in between. We'll be back with more next week, but in the meantime, you can stay in touch with us on Twitter. Our handle is FourthEstateAU. Thanks to my producer, Marlene Even, and my executive producer, Anthony Dockrell. I'm Monica Attard, and thank you for listening.